And it's later in the day than typical. It is just about 1400 hours, 2 p.m. for you civilian time, Central Standard Time. And I'll be bringing Nick Ferguson on in a bit. And we're just going to kind of riff on a bunch of stuff with permaculture design. We're going to talk about some things that Nick's going to be doing in the really close future. Our workshop that Nick will be at, some of the stuff we'll be teaching there, him and I both, along with some other things going on. We're going to even talk about some gun stuff today and just a bunch of cool stuff. We had to whip this all up in about 30 to 45 minutes between us because my scheduled guest no-showed me today. And, you know, once I got to like 10 minutes past start time and didn't hear anything from him, I just gave up and I reached out to Nick and he's like, yeah, we can do something. So we're going to have a great show today, just a little bit later in the day than typical. Before I bring Nick on, though, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone, where you can own your technology. That's right, own your technology so that your device maker, your provider, your app makers, all those people, yeah, they quit spying on you and selling all your information to the government. You can learn more at AbovePhone.com, where you can find the best privacy laptops, tablets, and phones on the market. And if you're an Above Phone customer, you get $75 off any phone at AbovePhone.com, and if you're thinking, it's new tech, I won't be able to work it. Yeah, you will. They'll give you an Above Phone certified expert that will give you a 45-minute onboarding session for your new device. Here's the thing. I'm not sure about the tablets. I don't have one, but if you get the Above Book, the computer, you won't need them. They have a whole series of videos preloaded on them. It tells you how to do everything. Really, really great stuff. Next up today, John Pugliano and the Wealth Steadying Podcast. I have known John a very long time, about as long as anybody that we work with on the show up to this day. I first met John in 2010 at a prepper convention out in Salt Lake City, Utah. We started working together right away, and he's still here. He's actually going to be presenting at our fall workshop, which is pretty common of him. And he's such a good dude. He's actually sponsoring our Friday night meal, which will be catered by Lupe Tortilla. He is a great investment manager and a pretty damn good podcaster, puts out about one episode a week. And you can find that at the Wealth Steadying Podcast at wealthsteading.com. You can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. And what you'll hear on the podcast is what he's doing with his money and what he's doing with his clients' money right now so that you can make better and smarter investing decisions for yourself. And with that, I want to welcome our special guest today, Nick Ferguson. Nick, how you doing, man?
Pretty good. Always glad to be on here.
Hey, man, thanks again for being here because being left in a lurch sucks. And I'll just say it for you AI doubters, thank God for AI because we were able to spin up a completely new format, show graphics, everything in about 15 minutes. Without Nick, that wouldn't work either. I would have had to come up with something on my own and pulled it completely out of my ass instead of half out of my ass. It's half-assed out of the ass, I guess, right? Half-assed. Anyway, Nick, welcome to the show, man. Let people know, like, since the last time you've been on, what's going on in your life?
Oh, geez, what has not been going on? I think since the last time I was on the show, we had a new baby. We had baby number four. So we is fat, happy, healthy. She was born like 100th percentile for size. It was the biggest baby this midwife had ever seen or delivered. yeah, she was I think like an inch and a quarter away from being tied for the longest child ever recorded. She's pretty tall. Too. Yeah. And that was to a baby born to two people with giantism. Yeah. So yeah, that was an event. I'm mostly
a girl too. Usually like big babies are usually males, not usually girls to be that.
Yeah. Big. Yeah. So so we are mostly getting sleep again. We are working on transitioning to hopefully getting on this new Kilgore property. That'll be real exciting if we can pull that off and make that happen. still nothing 100% solid on that. It's been a long road coming, but yeah, a lot of that. I'm working on a bunch. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to let people know if you hear any echoey modulation or whatever from Nick's end, he's got a, like, just compounds, right? He's got a tropical storm going over him right now, and he uses Starlink, so we'll just work through it. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I apologize if I drop out. You know, we're just going to have to roll with it. I've got that hurricane had made landfall, and we've got some bands of weather coming across, and that is the one downfall of Starlink is it sometimes pops in and out if there's clouds overhead. Yeah, I'm working on some online video courses. And some book outlines. I've got a lot of coursework coming up, hopefully, for this next year, and possibly even some books. It just depends on – and we just found out, like, a few days ago, we are expecting baby number 5, and we were not ready for that. But – you know, you just roll with the punches. So it's going to be an interesting winter for us, for sure.
It's like, you know, you guys were trying for a girl and trying for a girl because you had 3 boys. You had this big gap between the last boy and the first girl, and it takes forever. And
yep.
You know, you asked for it, so we'll just give you another one.
Yeah, I mean, 3 years of nothing, and yeah. And then bam, bam. So, hey,
yeah,
you just roll with what life throws at you. It's going to be good.
We just kind of threw together a mishmash of topics. And one of the things that you came up with on your end while I was putting the show together is some current event stuff that I didn't even think about. Suppressors, right? 200 stamp with a $200 stamp with a zero. Huge demand. Anybody can get a tube that screws on the end of a barrel now, and it's not a firearm or whatever. However, like, I didn't really – with what we're talking about today, you didn't really make a connection, but like you're saying, hey, this is also an opportunity for things like pest control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we can make anything a gun topic. That's why.
Right. So like I'm looking at, you know, I'm going to talk about some hypotheticals because we don't know what exactly the ATF is going to be doing in the next few months. So, but I mean, hypothetically speaking, it, by all accounts, it looks like, because there's no tax, it's a form, 4470 or whatever. I can't remember what the form is, but it's just a standard gun transfer form.
Yep.
Especially for someone in Texas, because I mean, the whole made in Texas suppressor thing isn't really, you know, that great of protection. But if you're a gun member, a GOA member, and so you're party to this injunction, I think there could hypothetically be a whole heck of a lot to say for something like, oh, I don't know, a Bamboo Labs 3D printer for about $600. And some carbon fiber nylon filament and a couple little pieces of metal. And all of a sudden, I mean, lower velocity stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. Subsonic 300 blackout.
Yeah.
22s. All of this. You know, I'm thinking about this not from the, you know, high level titanium, super, you know, super performance type stuff, but like just the, you know, I don't want to wake up people. I don't want to disturb neighbors, and I need to pop off at some rodent, some varmint, and I can turn out one of these for like $1 and then just reuse the hardware. I mean, if there's a baffle strike on a little bit of filament,
yeah,
who freaking cares? You just pull out the metal threaded end that heads onto your barrel. Reuse it.
All right. I'm actually really pondering, and this is really not a pest suppression thing, but the 8-6 blackout, like that, that's caught my attention in a big way. Oh, yeah. That the sectional density on a 338 bullet is insane for, you know, weight ratio to length of that dart-like shape. And they are, with a suppressor, dead quiet. I mean, that's a big pistol, still going pretty fast for the weight, size, and penetration ability, and it's almost movie quiet, you know.
And you look at some of these cartridges that they're turning out, the bullet itself opens up into basically what looks like a 3-inch wide, you know, triple bladed broadhead. Have you seen those? Isn't that nuts?
I wonder how practical they'd actually be, but I'm willing to find out.
Right?
I'm willing to find out.
I'm interested in trying it out. I mean, yeah. Just imagine you're a hog, you know, and you're just doing pig things, and then all of a sudden, thwack, with a 3-inch broadhead just crunching your
at 800 feet per side, second,
right?
That's the thing, at 800 feet per second, right? Like, wow.
And Bob right next to him is like, hey Frank, why are you laying down? What's up? Nap time.
Yeah, that is my main thought behind the 8-6 blackout, is just, you know, behind the ear, good night, go out, and Bob's looking at Bill going, bro, what's wrong?
Yeah, what's going on? He didn't hear anything. It's just a meaty thwack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did she fart? I do think we all need to be a little bit careful with what we do with this so far, but we do also need to not be afraid to do something. I think this is pretty much a done deal now, and that going forward, if you want a suppressor, you're just gonna be able to get a suppressor. They can only let that go for so long before, like, you can't put it back in the bottle. You need a new law or something like that. And it would have to be a totally different angle that they would have to take now. You got to get it through Congress. And I don't see it. And what's always been stupid, and I don't think a lot of people know this, like, yes, it's hard to own a gun in Germany. But if you do and you want a suppressor, you can go to the hardware store and buy a suppressor. You don't need to do anything. There's no paperwork. There's no nothing. In Germany, mm-hmm. in France, in Italy, if you have the license for the gun, you just buy the suppressor. And in SBR, there's no such thing. They don't differentiate like that. A rifle's a rifle. A handgun's a handgun. Done the end. Go out. There's no, like, some arbitrary 16-inch number, and we're making the flash suppressor a little bit longer just to please some guy with a tape measure. And so I think maybe we're actually in, like, we've always been ahead of the world on guns, but on some levels we've been behind, and maybe we're catching up in those areas.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hopeful that we're going to see such a tide rise that you almost can't say anything other than these are now in common use, because 20, 30, 40 million people have purchased them in the last 3-4 months.
And that is part
if
of
that
the
happens,
rule of common
I
use.
I think there's, that it's just, it's going to be so much in common use at that point, and there's going to be so much public sentiment around safety. You know, it's hearing safety.
It is hearing safety. And people think you're just making, like, when they call marijuana medicine or whatever, right? Like, well, that's also true in some ways, but this is really true. Like, I have shot with people for a long time that have paid the money, and we have suppressors under the old system, and it's kind of considered, like, rude to show up for a shoot without your suppressor because it's loud and it's annoying and nobody wants to hear your shit. Like, it's all from, you know what it is. It's the James Bond shit.
Yeah.
And then, like, this, like, three people die at, like, 1,000 yards. Like, this is not how that works, but let's kind of move on to some other stuff in your current events file. So, like, cattle herd is at a 75-year low. Grocery beef is expensive. And Trump started bringing this lean beef import in. Ranchers say it won't stop drop prices. I'm not sure if you've been listening to me or you figured this out on your own, but the reason for the lean beef, what they're actually doing, they're not bringing in cuts. They're bringing in trim. And they're mixing the European trim with our fat, because as we stuff our cattle full of corn, we have much fattier cattle than the rest of the world. So we take all our really premium beef and we send it to like Japan and Korea, right? And then we have all this trim for cheap ground, but then we end up with like 60-40 freaking meat, you know, and that doesn't work. So we import this lean and we're just blending it with our own. That's what they're actually doing.
Yeah. I don't want to buy pink slime stuff from Argentina.
Yeah. 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 But your solution is small ruminants, home finished meats, you know, then waiting for $3 beef to come back.
Yeah. I think if we get more people, that are starting to, even if we're just, it's just a little bit, if it's just a little bit, that's going to help kind of moderate some of those higher prices. And who knows, you might just decide, hey, I like this so much, and adding, you know, doubling the number of animals is really not that much extra work.
Yeah.
And I have the land for it. I have the capacity for it. Or, you know, I'm budgeting smart. And because we're converting sunlight into meat and we're harvesting that value ourselves, and you start reallocating some of that budget into like fencing or infrastructure so that you can ramp up even more.
Yeah.
That's, man, it's just, it's like a debt snowball, except it's like a wealth snowball, I think, and it's resiliency. So I'd like to see more people doing that. I'd like to see more people that have just like, even if it's 1 acre, you could always get a couple lambs and tractor them on your property. You don't have to have a ton of fencing infrastructure.
That's true. I also think we have a real potential for people to start maybe finally waking up. Like, it's gotten expensive enough, they'll start considering alternatives, because not everybody wants to raise sheep or goats or whatever. Right. But what you can do is you find one person with the land that wants to do it, or even one person with the land and one person that wants to do it. And basically you form like a neighborhood or, you know, a regional co-op, and then you pay for that person to do that. And now you're eating better food for less money. I don't care if it's better food I'd rather eat that for the same money than be stuck, you know, buying from the grocery store or whatever. Because, you know, one thing I've become very in touch with is when you want to leave, the more animals you have, the harder that is.
Absolutely.
So creating some form of load sharing, that gives people optionality, and then people are more likely to do it. And I think people are more likely to do things when they don't feel like they're alone in it too. Like when they feel like other people are there for them. Like, I can take a break today and Nick can come over and, you know, move the sheep or whatever. And especially around, like, if you're going to self harvest around harvest time. And that's where I love the small ruminant angle. We were just talking about that on the show last week, that I can process a sheep or a lamb every bit as fast as I can do a deer. And I can take a deer from laying on the ground dead, hoisted up in a gambrel, quartered in a cooler, while drinking a beer in 30 minutes. Right? I can't break down a chuck roll in 30 minutes.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like just that one front, you know, part of a quarter of a cow.
Right.
It's just so much more work just because of size.
Yeah.
You know, just because of size. I did a cow processing workshop last year with Sean at Country Mama. And, you know, we had like 12 people in that workshop, and it took 2 days, the 3 days really, to process two cows. That's labor intense. Now everybody was learning and stuff, you know, but still, like, You start processing a lamb, or like, I just learned what they're called when they're old, too old to be a lamb, but they're not a mutton yet. Helberg or something like that, or something. Anything in that size class, just no real time at all to it. It's super easy. I also like, you know, people say lamb from the store is gamey. And I don't know who I was talking to about this, because I don't believe that gamey is a front flavor. I don't know where the gamey taste buds are on my tongue. But there is a flavor that I can – I don't hate it, but I can see why somebody else would be like, nah, I don't care for that. And I've said, like, all the lamb I've eaten that's produced domestically doesn't have that flavor. And I don't even remember who I was talking to, and they said – I think it was Billy Bond. That because we do hair sheep here mostly instead of wool sheep, and there's something about the sheep that produce more of like a true wool – that they have that flavor. I always thought it was what they were eating or what the kind of pasture they were on. And maybe there was something in New Zealand that tasted like that. And no, it's, that's the biggest thing. I think it has something to do with lanolin, he said.
Hmm. I can see that.
Yeah. Look, I didn't make that happen. So yeah. Yeah. I had no idea because like I brought one back from John's place, John Willis's place. And it was probably like a 16 month old animal. And I thought maybe it would be a little bit more of that. That was none. Like,
yeah.
I think you were here when we made that last year. Or maybe you got here too late. You got here too late for it. You got screwed by a day.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I
everybody got... had blood like running down their hands. And
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Nicole shoved about 8 heads of garlic into it and a bunch of rosemary. And we threw it on the smoker. And then we finished it on the flat top real quick just to cook it through a little bit more. It was amazing. And I'm like, how is it that good? And
no, I was there for that.
Okay, you were there for that. Okay, I thought so. But we were anything special. He just had it out on his pasture. Yeah. He's not doing like a Greg Judy level management or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was delicious. And I really think more people need to think about that. And the people that say they don't like lamb, I think you need to try some domestically produced hair lamb, whatever the hell you want to call it. St. Croix, you know, a Katahdin, whatever. Dorper. There's just something. It tastes like mild beef.
It does. It tastes like I always try describe it like a cross between beef and venison.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good. Yeah. It's got a little bit more intramuscular fat than venison does, and it's a little more beefy like. What do you think about the screw worm, man? The Mexican screw worm. We're getting screwed by the screw worm.
It's a little bit butt clenchy, the hope that I have is that it's going to bring up a not resurgence, but an increase, a bump up in the interest in biological or ecological control measures. And so what I mean by that is there's a guy that on YouTube, he goes by like Tick Creek Ranch or something. He's doing a lot of, you know, Greg Judy style, Salatin style grazing. And he coined this term mosaic grazing, which, you know, for us that are familiar with permaculture stuff, if you had your silvopasture designed the way you and I like to design things,
okay,
this would just automatically be integrated into the system because we'd have our swales with trees, and you know, we've got the multiple different tiers in a forest. So we've got the overstory, we've got kind of that understory, and then we have that marginal edge species. We'd have some of those herbaceous plants that are kind of tall. And if you're within a certain radius of that, what you'll have is dragonflies are looking for prey. And dragonflies, I'm sure you're familiar with this, they have like, it's like a 98% success hunt kill rate.
Yeah, they're pretty badass, man. They're underrated.
It's
they're one of the most murderous creatures.
They are the most incredible hunters known to man.
Yeah.
As far as kill rate goes. And so, so, you know, what he's been doing is he's been kind of strip grazing, but he will leave some of that forage tall. And what he said he's noticed is he has way, way more dragonflies that are zipping over top of his cattle. And he has almost no fly pressure as a result because the dragonflies are snatching them all out of the sky.
Mm.
So what I think it might do is the smart producers are going to be doing things like putting in strips of trees to provide a little bit of shade and also provide some of that habitat. So like, one of the things that I'm really interested in doing on this, this, you know, East Texas property, again, if we get it, I'm really interested in putting in swales just slightly off contour because I want to be able to flow water downhill. So basically what I'll end up with is little sections that are maybe 100 foot long that are on contour, and then it drops down just a hair.
And yeah, then it drops down just a hair. 1% or 0.5% grade.
Right. Right. And then I implement some chinez, a swale across the whole pasture. But I can also turn those swivel pipes up and I can have 6 inches, 4 inches of water with reeds, and I can have premium mosquito fish and dragonfly larva habitat. I can be breeding dragonflies.
Yeah.
Right there within 50 to 100 feet of the cow's backs or the sheep's backs. So I'm hopeful that this possible really bad problem with screwworm will actually bring some of these techniques and principles and practices into a little bit more of the mainstream, because all it takes is just one or two people being able to show it, demonstrate it, and it hit the news, and it's going to start getting some traction because it's pretty damn cheap. It's pretty damn simple.
And if you give them water, it works. You've been here. I don't have any real ponds.
Right.
Like, I couldn't build them. I even tried. Spent thousands of dollars on a hole. But even with just all my little tank ponds, my stock tank ponds and my Miyagi ponds, I have dragonflies out the ass.
Yes,
and
you do.
I'm starting to see some this year that I'm like, I've never even seen you before. Like mauves and fuchsias and these gorgeous different dragonflies. Yeah. And they don't breed in the pool.
Really cool.
But they're always skimming the pool too. Like, you go in the pool and there's like freaking dragonflies just skimming you everywhere. But if I go out like in the spring before they really start to heavily hatch, and I take like a little dip net and I go up under like my water hyacinths and stuff, I have, I'll come out, there'll be a half a dozen to a dozen nymphs in there. For those who don't know, a nymph is the larval stage of a dragonfly. I'm also starting to see Dobson flies. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different level of scientific nightmare fuel for, like,
those are crazy looking.
The Helgramite larva that they come from. If you've ever seen Star Trek II: Wrath of Khan, and the thing that Khan puts in their ears to control their minds, if that's not inspired by a Helgramite, I don't know what it's inspired by. It's exactly what it looks like.
Science fiction horror.
Yeah, the Dobson fly. If you don't know what we're talking about, guys, just get on Google, type in Dobson fly, and hit images. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that number one, it works. Number two, like, what do you have to lose by adding that habitat to your operation? It certainly gains a lot, and is, it also fits with drought proofing a property.
Yeah,
which we need a little bit less right now. Like I told you, I just flew in from West Virginia on Sunday, and when we came over to Dallas Fort Worth, everything's brown. Everything's like my property gets brown this time of year every year because there's no dirt here. But everything, like, you see 50 miles, and if it ain't irrigated, it is brown. This is a brutal year, man, with this weather system that we'll talk about later. But hey, you even brought debt and auction panic in here from my show last week. $40 trillion we now owe. $40 trillion. I remember I wrote an article about voting, of all things, in like 2016, I think. And I said this was coming. And people thought I was crazy. Like, it'll never have $40 trillion. We'll be just bankrupt. Like, we are bankrupt, and it's going to be $40 trillion, right? But what a family can do, let's say on 40 raw acres while the clock runs, because we need to be doing things that actually benefit us at this point in some type of tangible ROI way. I'm all for making things pretty and gorgeous and whatever, but like, we need to be putting in the kind of systems that feed people first.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, whenever I'm doing these consulting tours, I'm talking to my clients, and for myself included, you know, it's great to invest in things like, you know, mutual funds or whatever, precious metals. But man, if I don't have first and foremost the ability to make sure that my family is fed next week, next month, all of the rest of that, you know, you can only eat lead once.
Yeah.
You can't eat gold really at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm looking at these systems of support and just thinking, and I didn't get to listen to your show. I was hoping you could kind of give me a little bit of the Cliff's Notes consequences for what we might be looking at. But you know, I just thought that was a really, really staring us in the face, kind of like this 08 telegraphed punch. You know, I saw that coming. I know you saw that coming. And I see some stuff coming with this debt wall.
Yeah.
I mean, I could be wrong on this, but haven't we surpassed our like a debt to GDP ratio?
Yeah, it's like 124%. Yeah, it's like 124% debt to GDP.
Yeah, like,
and GDP is the entire economy for a year. And the entire economy for a year is freaking inflated anyway and bullshit. Like half of the number they put in the GDP isn't even real, right? Like the government billing the government for the government services to the government, or one of the real games they played, and this is just psychotic, where I think they did this about 10 years ago, so around 2016. Like if they determine this year that they have the city has a pension fund, and they know this year because of what happened, they're going to pay out X amount in the future, that goes in this year's GDP. Don't even ask me to fully explain it, because it's so retarded, I don't understand exactly how they, you know, do you do it again every year? I mean, like, I'm not sure. But there's three big triggers that we're talking about here. And one is the auction panic that you had in your notes. And that is that the idea that if we can't sell our debt, we have to buy it ourselves. So we're printing money to print money to print money at that point, with the Federal Reserve as the buyer of last resort. So the Federal Reserve is buying its own bonds with the money that it printed by issuing a bond. And if that sounds ridiculous, it's because it is. Well, that just triggers a panic. And then that leads to the people holding the existing debt that they already bought, dumping it, right? So that can create a cascade effect. That's one potential big problem. The other is just the math trap, right?
Right.
So if you look between here and 2036, so 10 years, our net interest will double. Our net interest will double. I remember I wrote a book called The Truth About Money in about 2011, and I talked about the national debt interest, just the interest, exceeding the cost of Social Security. Well, here you go. And the only reason it's not going to exceed the Department of Defense is, well, we just raised that to $1.5 trillion. But, I mean, we're looking at like about a $2.1 trillion a year expense. $2.1 trillion. Nick, trillion's real money. It starts to add up, right? $2.1 trillion a year to fund the interest payments, okay? And then if you go to the third trigger, this is where, like, with these other two things happening, we're the world reserve currency. And the way I always explain that is, imagine that the United States had a reserve currency of oranges, mm-hmm. right? And no matter what you bought, you had to first convert it into orange futures, and then you could buy the other thing. That's kind of how the world economy works with the dollars. You have to take your rupees or your ruples or your, you know, pesos or whatever it is, your ass white money, and you turn it into less bad money, and then you can spend it. And more countries are going around that, but it's still in place. We still have what they call the petrodollar. Mm-hmm. So if we had that in the United States with oranges, like California and Florida would be in really good shape, and Texas wouldn't be quite as screwed as some other places, but we don't grow that many oranges. But Maine or Pennsylvania, like here, I don't know how many Wolfatis you're going to put in, but you're going to have a problem. You're going to have to like pay basically a conversion rate, you know? Wallapini, that's what those things are called, Wallapinis, right? Like you're only going to grow so many oranges in Pennsylvania or Nebraska. We have had this unfair advantage since World War II. And sooner or later, it's going to go away. And to me, when you put those three together, do they all hit? Do they partially hit? I don't think it matters. Like the inflation drive, if you think inflation was about between 2020 and 2026, what do you see what it looks like over the next 10 years? It's going to be crippling. I figured this out, and this is if it doesn't get any worse. If it just stays like it is, your kiddo that was just born, right?
Mm-hmm.
When she turns 65 and wants to draw Social Security to live at the same standard a person on Social Security lives on today, which ain't good, she'll need between $125,000 to $135,000 a year in Social Security. Like, that should just stop everybody's heart, because most people, if you're making that right now, you're like, I'm pretty good. That's going to be, you know, poverty-level Social Security wages 65 years from today. That's basic straight math, and that's if it doesn't get any worse. So the stuff that Nick's talking about with feeding yourself and all, man, I think we all need to take this very seriously, very, very seriously, because we're starting to look at, like, Weimar numbers now, man. It's terrible. I don't think it goes as fast because of where we're at, but – you can die. Like, it doesn't matter if you're chained to the floor and the water's filling in, right? You have longer to figure out how to escape, but once it goes over your nose, it doesn't matter that it was slow.
Right.
And I think that's like, we're literally, when you say drowning in debt, like, yeah, but the water's up to our nipples. Mm-hmm. And so we're like, yeah, I feel pretty good. Yeah, okay. So I think we do need to be thinking more about ways to eat, and kind of moving on from that, like, I've been trying to figure out different little cool little things you can do to not really necessarily put a lot of calories in, but add variety to what you're producing. And I've been playing with this thing that you and I have known about for years called a marbled crayfish. And you, when you were out here and I took you around at night with a flashlight and showed you what's happened, you're like, wow, they've really blown up. Well, since you were here, I've started to do some population surveys.
Mm-hmm.
And I got this little bitty crawfish trap. It's really a fish trap. And I'll throw like a handful of algae wafers in there and set it and throw it in one of my tanks. These are like 150-gallon tanks. I'll come back in 20 minutes. There's 100 of them in there. And what makes them so cool, Nick? What makes the marble crayfish different than all the other crayfish in the world?
I love it. They will self-clone.
Yep. Yep. They
will just explode.
Yep. And it took a while.
Yeah, I think it was. I think they came out of the aquarium trade, and I think it was a guy in Germany.
Germany found the first one.
Yep. And they just started replicating in his tank, and I think he only had one.
Yeah.
And they just kept replicating and replicating. And
the first mutation. And
yep.
They say somehow they don't know how they got to Madagascar. There's a lot of hungry people in Madagascar. I think somebody figured out what they did and started throwing them in ditches. Mm-hmm. Because that's like a prime food source in Madagascar now. So I'm like, well, I'm going to get these things. And I did what everybody did. I played with them in regular aquariums for several years. And this giant explosion of population never happened. They would make more and whatever. When I put them out in active, biologically rich systems, all of the things you saw here came from four of them. I threw four one tank about 2.5 years ago. And as soon as I threw them in there, I'm like, dumbass, you should have put one in each tank. I'm like, okay, when you put it now, you're not getting them out. And they've gone through the systems, and they're everywhere that fish aren't. Like, mm-hmm. when you get into the big tanks in the lower end of the system where there's catfish and stuff, no, that's food at that mm-hmm. point. But, man, they're everywhere. And they're not as big as, like, the ones they raise commercially in Louisiana. But they're pretty good size. And, you know, if it's something mm-hmm. you want to pull a couple dozen out here and there to add variety to your meal, basically you're growing shrimp at home. That's the way I look at it. And my big issue with them, they survive outside in the winter. That's – and you've seen, I've had my tanks completely freeze over. There's probably that much unfrozen water in there. They don't care. They don't care at all. They're hanging out in there. Now, they are supposedly an invasive species threat. I don't see them being a huge problem. I just don't. Now, I'm not saying to go out and risk rocking them out into reservoirs or anything, but what's a big invasive problem in Texas? Fire ants. What eats fire ants? Nothing. What eats crayfish?
Everything.
Everything eats a crayfish, you know?
Yeah.
Any legality to owning them? There's no, I think state by state, some states have started to restrict them. They've talked about it here, but, you know, there's also a case for just keeping your mouth shut. But, I mean, right now, except for two states, I think you can just, like, go online and, like, order them from Aquatic Arts and they will ship them to you in a box. I can go down to a fish store that has a really great burger joint next to it. You know where it's at, Nick. And I can go in there and buy them, and they'll put them in a bag, and I can bring them home. I would say be responsible, because one of the things I've learned from them is that they will travel through just about anything. So if your system in any way discharges, it will discharge little crayfish at some point. I've seen some of my systems I know to get where they got to, they didn't just have to go down for a Wet n Wild ride. They had to actually be sucked into a pump, survive the impeller, and get shot, and they still made it. So when they're pretty little like that. So if you live like on a property with a creek or something, and if you're going to do them in any way in sort of an outside environment, you are risking introducing them into the outdoor environment.
Right.
If you have a stock pond on your property, I'm less concerned about it because where are they going to go? But like any kind of water that moves off your property and they walk. And here's the thing. If they're going to be this invasive thing that they say they're going to be, there's enough of them here now. It's going to happen anyway.
Right.
Right. I mean, they are. It's what like, they are.
Yeah. It's kind of like the white mulberry. People freak out. It's not native to North America. It's a Chinese. It's already here. It's been here since I think the 1800s. It's been in the wild. Birds are eating the seeds. Birds are spreading them. There's nothing we can do at this point.
No.
So like when I've got clients or customers that are a little bit iffy about planting white mulberry on their property, that they're going to be coppicing, that aren't going to be producing seeds anyways, just to feed their livestock. And they're like, I don't know, because it's not native. It's native to planet Earth. There's
57 of them in the bar ditch over there right now, so maybe we should stop worrying. I've noticed that, like, the things that we get really concerned about or want to ban, it's already the horse out of the barn. Like, you know, that Florida is big on, can't have water hyacinths. Well, I just watched 5 acres of it float down the St. John's River. So, what's that shit, David? Like, water lettuce?
Yep.
Well, yeah, that's illegal in Texas, supposedly. Go down to Corpus Christi or whatever. Every bar ditch, everywhere. And you know how much of it's up here? None, because unless you bring it inside, it doesn't make it through the winter. I will say the water hyacinth thing. I have had it survive some pretty rough winters. Like one little piece, and that's all that it takes. And so I would be careful with that. But I think a lot of it gets overdone. And if we end up with all the crazy shit we're talking about happening. If you have an invasive species that feeds you, I mean, isn't there a point where we...
What an awful problem to have.
Yeah. Yeah. let's talk about this. Like, a lot of people want that piece of land. And then they get that piece of land, and then they do all the things at one time. And you're looking at moving on to a new piece of land soon. And you know what you're doing from the point of view. You've literally done hundreds of on-site consultations and projects throughout Florida to freaking Washington State to California to Maine, with no exaggeration. And a lot of the things that people would do immediately when they get on a piece of property, not only would you advise them not to do, you wouldn't do it either, certainly not first. So what are some of the things that you will not do first on a new property? You would advise pretty much anybody else to do it either.
Yeah. So, so some of the things that I always see, like, people will like almost immediately, they'll be thinking, okay, I need fill in the blank fruit trees, because they've heard rightly the best time to plant a fruit tree is 20 years ago. Second best time is today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, within reason, because I'll see people, and with the price of fruit trees nowadays, you go on some of these websites, and it's like $75 for an apple tree. And I mean, if they've got a warranty on it and they'll replace it once in the first year if it dies, and you're on a brand new piece of property, you don't have deer protection, you don't have infrastructure, you don't have irrigation, you've got some garden hoses, and you go and you spend $2,000 on fruit trees on day one to get them put in the ground because the best time to plant them is today, right? Because that's what you're told.
Yeah. Even if it's the 4th of July.
Man. That $2,000 is gone. It's just gone. So what I always encourage people to do is, and what I will be doing myself, I'm preaching at the choir. I will do this myself on our new piece of property. The first trees going in the ground are always going to be hardy support species. They're going to be the pioneer species. It's going to be things like hybrid poplar, hybrid willow. It's going to be white mulberry. It's anything that is going to start adding root exudates, start dropping leaves, start producing mulch in place. I'm basically going to be growing mulch in place. So instead of spending $2,000 on fruit trees, I'm going to spend $2,000 on fodder trees and support species. And I'm going to get those ecosystems growing and supporting the eventual planting of the more expensive fruit trees. So that's one of those big things. Another one is everyone, you know, cows, they want their, you know, the big
We lost you at cows.
Yep. Okay, great. Then I didn't I saw it start to do the little spinny wheel of death. You know, they'll want those big sexy, you know, big ticket item things, like I want the cows. And I want them too. However, if I've got, you know, $2,000, $3,000 invested in one cow, well, I compare that to, you know, $3,000 invested in some sheep or some goats. I have my investment spread into a whole bunch of other baskets, so to speak. If one of those animals gets sick, I haven't lost my entire investment. And then on top of that, the infrastructure is a whole lot easier. I've known friends, I've done it myself. I've caught a milk cow before I had the infrastructure ready, and that was a big mistake. I regret it to this day, and I won't do it again. I've got friends that have done the same thing, and they invested a whole bunch of money, and they tied out their cow and tied her up and moved her around and moved her around and moved her around, and then one day she ends up dying, and then they lost all that investment, all that time, all that effort, and it's just gone. And so, you know, you could start with a couple miniature dairy goats, some Nigerian dwarf dairy goats, and you get yourself four sheep and goat panels. It's the 4-inch by 4-inch mesh. They're rigid, and you can connect them with chain quick links. They've got the little spinny nut on them, so it tightens up, and it's not going to come apart like a you know, a zip tie or something else. They can't bust it open. And you put that together and you have a four-sided pen. Well, with another person, you could pick that up and just drag it. One footprint. You could do that in the morning, do that in the evening.
If you have to, I can tell you, you can do it alone. You just pull a corner and a corner and a corner. It's a pain in the butt, but I've done it. I've brooded ducklings and goslings in a 16 by 16 structure, just like you're talking about, except I had to put chicken wire on it because they can get through the hole. So you could do it alone, but you could debt two people. It's not even hard.
Right. And so like this new property that we're looking at, it has barbed wire fence on it. It's not the best. It's keeping cows in right now. So I could go straight to cows. However, I'm not going to. I'm going to start with the smaller herbivores, and I'm going to start with that exact system that I just described, and I'm just going to tractor them, and I'm going to start building up that that population. And over the next year or so, I'm going to start bumping up my fencing and getting that more secure so that I can start building that up. And then out of the excess of those initial herbivores, I'm going to start selling off breeders and then take that profit and dump it right into buying my initial breeding stock for cattle.
Mm.
And so I'm going to let that, it's not like a hobby, but I'm going to let that system build up the wealth that lets me build the next system, that lets me build the next system. So I'm taking those same principles of function stacking, if you will, with the support species and the apple trees, for instance. I'm taking that exact same principle with my livestock. So with quail and rat, I'm taking that and just cascading that system into more resiliency and more productivity. So those are two of the big things. One of the other big ones is I'll see people, and I've had the tendency to do this myself, is they'll get on a new piece of property and they'll be like, okay, so where are we putting in our swales day one? And you're like, no, let's not. It's great to have that plan, certainly. You know, because this is what I always do. I say, where do you want to be in 5 to 10 years? And then we work backwards from there to create kind of a staged out plan. And swales are almost never going to be a year one project, because they're relatively high investment for a relatively low ROI immediately. And so what I always try and encourage people to do, and I'm taking this advice myself, is you start with your zone one. You and I have both encouraged people in the past to focus on zone one. Keep stuff close to the buildings. You're going to spend far, far less energy and effort than reaching out and doing broadacre stuff. So before you start putting in ponds and swales and stuff really far out in the landscape, those mainframe, huge infrastructure investments, before you start that, get your zone one really, really going well. I'm not saying it has to be mastered. I'm not saying it has to be super productive, but get all that zone one stuff really nailed down and starting to function before you even consider reaching out into your broader acreage, your zone three and four kind of spaces. So stick close, tight to your house site. Get, even if it's just a couple little raised beds, so you're raising some tomatoes and peppers and just some little stuff. It's so freaking convenient.
So we're getting you modulating here and there again, man. I'll kind of add to that.
Right,
and maybe we'll get a deep spooling here. My view on that is, until you have a functional zone one, get a chain, put it on your leg that only reaches to the edge of where your zone one is, and you're not allowed out there unless you have a reason, and then you can unlock the padlock. Like, I would say, like, ponds and stuff, like, if you have an ideal situation and you know you can put a pond in and it's going to be in the right place and you want to do that right away, I'm fine with that. My big concern when you bring up swales is there's a lot of property that don't need any swales. You don't need any at all.
Right.
You're like, high rainfall, flat territory, and you're not doing the swales for other hydrological reasons. If you're only doing it to plant a food forest or something, you don't need it. In fact, it can be an impediment, because now you're locked into a certain pattern and framework, because you did find that little bit of contour that's there, but now you've got this ditch going through the center of things. And that can be wonderful. It also can be like, you never needed this. Right. Like, if you go to a place, say, what's your average annual rainfall? 60 inches. I am looking more at how I can use a swale to move water away from places than I am at infiltration at that point. Like, a little bit of irrigation in year one, and I get tap roots now. I don't have a tree. Forget it. I don't have to do anything again. and is you know, you can do little footpath things, little swale-like features, but real swales, as Jeff Lawton teaches, are tree-growing systems. So why are you – I think that's a bigger thing is why are you doing the thing you say you want to do? And if you don't have a good answer to that, don't do it.
Put the brakes on. Focus on that zone. Your zone one will always need little bits of improvement. So focus on the stuff that's really close, really going to give you the highest ROI for the least amount of investment. And a lot of that stuff is going to be that zone one, zone two.
Gotcha.
And you know, that's where people end up spreading themselves too thin. And they get too many irons in the fire, and they end up just running around like a chicken with your head cut off, putting out fires for the next 4 or 5 years, spinning their wheels and not really accomplishing anything. Ask me how I know, because I did it.
We've all done it. Because you get excited, you want to do all the things. So you do all the things at once, and none of the things are done, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, none of the things ever get completely locked down. So what will you focus on first?
Yeah, so I mean, the biggest initial thing is because it's a complete blank slate. There is absolutely nothing. It's some really good pasture. There's no housing. There's really no infrastructure. There's no water. I mean, it's going to be over 1,000 feet of water line to hook up to the very tail end of a municipal water system. I really, really just don't want the dregs that are at literally the very last meter.
Yeah.
I really don't want that if I can avoid it at all. So I'm going to have to do a little bit of figuring out with that. But I mean, water, is going to be one of the big ones. And a structure. So we are actually going to be, wait a second. We're probably going to be putting in basically a small cabin with a loft to start out with just to meet our needs. Because, I mean, we're going to be a family of 3, 4, 5, 7. I'm having to count now.
He knew the answer,
like, I can't,
but his brain wouldn't let him say it. That's what happened right there.
It's Yeah, I thought it was 7, but I'm like, wait, no, three boys, one girl, and one new babe. Like, yeah, we're both having a little bit of cognitive dissonance about the news that we're already expecting another. but I mean, 7 people. You know, I know Patrick has done it on some pretty small cabin setups, but I don't know how they manage to sardine so many people. And for everyone to not like murder each other.
You haven't even halfway caught up to him yet.
I know. I haven't even. I'm apparently catching up, but I don't think I'll ever catch up to Patrick, and that's okay.
No. He drove past the hospital once, and a bunch of women had babies.
Right.
They weren't pregnant. They just popped out.
just the whiff of his manliness.
Beard. It's just weird. It has
the beard pheromones. But yeah, the initial housing, and then, you know, I plan on making that small enough that we can get it up and dried in and functional relatively fast. And then it needs to be small enough that I can get it up fast. And not so big that we are comfortable in it long term so that we can start working on a real house.
Yeah.
But then, you know, like I said earlier, it's going to be, I'm not going to be immediately throwing money at perimeter pasture fencing and going whole hog on the broad acre, you know, larger herbivores. We're going to be starting small. So I think it's going to be pretty tight to the homestead. And I'm actually really, really leaning towards getting like 1 or 2 bred sows and raising them Korean natural farming style. So yeah. on deep litter bedding with lactobacillus serum sprayed on the bedding. Because, I mean, just two of those pigs raising a couple litters a year and then buying a couple super sacks of feed through my local mill, that will produce a literal ton of meat.
Oh yeah.
That'll be high quality, and then we'll have a whole bunch of fantastic compost out of that afterwards. And then of course we can always sell some of those animals as breeding stock. So it doesn't have to be just a whole bunch of pork. I can be selling some breeding stock, and I can convert some of that breeding stock into, I mean, I could potentially even sell enough of those pigs as breeders to just like replace that income with a cow, a bred heifer.
Or to put in the infrastructure that you need to do the other things, right? And it's self-fund, basically.
Yeah.
What's your temporary living envelope? I don't know what that is.
Yeah. So that's what I'm talking about. That's that's one of those things that we were talking about with the first things first, is that, you know, basically kind of a cabin. You know, it's not going to be the most well finished thing, but it's going to be better than a camper.
Okay. You also have keep the work stacked. What do you mean by that?
So it's just, you know, basically, you know, the developing the land, again, we're talking about, a lot of clients will get, they'll get kind of spread too thin and they'll start working on those big ticket items. So basically what I was, you know, that little bullet point was just, we're going to need to make sure that we are not spreading ourselves too thin, biting off more than we can chew, keeping things, tight to the house, developing the land right around there. You know, I'm still going to be doing some consulting over the next year or so, getting the nursery ramped up so that we can be producing a bunch on site out there. That's one of the big things about getting out there that I'm really excited about, is I'm going to be able to really start branching out, pun intended, with the nursery, because it's a lot different location. I'm going to have a lot more sunlight. That's my main limiting factor here. Is everything's canopied out over here and everything is under almost complete shade. So, we'll be able to spread out quite a bit and get the nursery cranked up. And, I'm really excited about being able to do some vlogging and show kind of a blank slate. 'Cause that's basically what we're going to be doing is restarting from ground zero, complete blank slate. It should be a really interesting story to follow, because, I mean, I've been doing this kind of stuff for most of my life in some capacity or another, and professionally teaching and counseling people on how to set things up, how to design things well, troubleshooting systems, fixing systems, and you know, the vast majority of my clients have come back and said, wow, I never would have thought of that. I never would have designed it this way. I've had clients come back years later and say, you were absolutely right. We were going to get tired of that. We did get tired of that. And because you designed it this certain way, we were able to just completely just
slip right into.
They were able to just not have that infrastructure be an impediment. Instead, they just flipped into a different animal system, and it worked flawlessly because it was designed that way. I literally designed it that way from the get-go because I knew they were going to get tired of what they were starting out with, and they were going to change.
Yeah, one thing I've learned too is you have to design age into a system. So the system itself gets better with age, but we as humans get tired with age. And like the things that I was willing to do when I moved on this property – that I made it work where it can't work. And people are like, wow, you made it work. Yeah, I'm not making it work anymore. I'm like, you're going to die now because I'm done with you. Because, yes, you looked cool. Everybody went, ooh, ah, and I got, like, $10 worth of food off you this year for, like, $800 worth of my labor. You're going to die now. You don't have to die, but I'm going to let you die. If you figure out how to survive, like, you know, like the Mark Shepard stun method, it's like, mine was not intentional. It was just, like, eventually, like, that's what's happened to you. Right, you're going to die. Like, and for folks that are maybe new to my show, Nick's been doing this a long time, and I remember him coming out here one time. And he looked at something I planted, and they're supposed to be super hardy. I'm like, it died. He said, "Well, you made one mistake." And I said, "What was my mistake?" He goes, "You planted it here." And I'm like, "You mean the spot?" He goes, "No, here. Like here, where you live. Where you live kills things, you know."
Right.
And it is. It's just it's a harsh environment, but. Mm-hmm. What does work here proves how powerful what we do is.
Absolutely. So that's going to be really fun for me is to be able to kind of take this, all this experience and, you know, all of my mistakes and successes here on a suboptimal system location and roll that into a place, a location that is perfectly suited. It is fan-freaking-tastic. I'm so excited about it. And to be able to show, okay, what would Nick do on a brand new, you know, clean slate? Yeah. I'm going to be able to literally show that. And that's going to be really freaking cool to be able to see what that looks like day to day, year to year. So I'm really looking forward to being able to do that.
Now, you have worked with a lot of people, and you are fixing to go on the road again. And that means that people listening out, if you live in Timbuktu, L place, XYZA, off the grid in Idaho, unless you're going to whip out a really big checkbook, he's probably not coming to your house. We'll give you another option in a minute. So this is kind of a regional thing with the potential to maybe get a little bit further north. But tell people kind of what you're thinking. And if you hear that you're in these areas and you want to work with Nick, you can reach out to him about coming onto your property and doing some consulting work for you.
Yeah. So I've got a little bit, I've got a couple people interested in Texas, mostly like the central and eastern Texas. So there's a potential for a quick kind of like 3 or 4 day weekend kind of tour in Texas coming up in September. It just in the next couple of weeks. And I'm also going to be up in Oklahoma near the Tulsa area the end of September, putting in a nice size pond.
Okay.
So I'm going to be up there. So Arkansas, eastern Oklahoma, southwest Missouri kind of region. So there's an opportunity to snag me, you know, towards the end of September. And I've also got some people, especially around Atlanta. And there's one or two, I think, in the Tennessee region. So I might end up going up kind of through Little Rock over through Tennessee, then kind of swooping down towards the Atlanta region. And then possibly to, pretty close to the Gulf in, Alabama. So, I might be over there. So anywhere in those kind of regions, and there was someone interested in having me come up to Pennsylvania. So that's also a possibility. So that kind of East Coast tour might jump up to Pennsylvania and back down. Okay. But if you're in any of those areas, shoot me an email. I might be able to fit you in. I might not. You know, I might be able to fit you in after my October commitments and Jack's workshop. So it's nice to have those emails in so we can kind of start scheduling things out a little bit further. But for someone wanting to get me out to their property this year, it's going to be September. I'm going to have a short availability in November, and then maybe like 1 week in December where I can schedule. And then early next year for the first several months, especially with the baby expected end of April and tree shipping season, it's going to be really difficult for me to get away from the house. So
yeah, understood. Definitely understand that. Hey, so what about people who are like, I really want some help with figuring out what to do with my property, but, you know, I really don't fit Nick's schedule or, you know, current geography for the next quarter.
Yeah. And that's where distance consulting really, really comes in and really, really shines. I just did a consult with someone up in Massachusetts, and, you know, we spend a couple hours on a video call like this. There's screen sharing so that we're both on the same page, and I'm able to point out features on their landscape. And, you know, we got towards the end of it and, you know, kind of wrapping up, and I, you know, asked if there's anything else, and she held up 4 pages of notes. She's like, this was amazing. I have 4 pages of notes. We didn't think that we'd, you know, get this much covered and get this much really good actionable information. So distance consults, while it's not, you know, it's not nearly as good as me being boots on the ground, but because I've been like Jack, you pointed out, I've been coast to coast. On one of my tours up north, I saw Canada. I didn't go into Canada, but
it was there.
But it was there.
Yeah.
And you know, from almost the Canadian border, coast to coast, down into like the Southern Hemisphere. I've been all the way down to Ecuador and Central America doing consulting. I've been on a lot of locations. It's probably in the thousands at this point. Because I've been to so many of these,
he's locked again.
I'm, yeah. Notice,
big band of clouds over Nick's head.
Yeah, those bands are coming over. I've noticed I've been able to notice details that I hadn't prior to the last couple years. So I think it's getting a whole lot easier for me to do distance consulting, just because I'm able to recognize a lot of these features, and maybe people are doing a better job at videoing their tours of their properties. But a distance consult is a really quick and easy thing. It's low entry. It's really cheap for what you actually get. And it's really quick and easy with technology now. Like, you don't need to send me a thumb drive. You don't need to send anything by mail. Like, we can do a digital payment through a web portal, and you can upload your video to YouTube as an unlisted file, so nobody's gonna see it. And then I'll watch it, and then you just delete it, and it's gone.
Yeah.
And people that worry really too much about that, way.
And then don't worry too much about somebody finding your unlisted video, because people are out there screaming to try to get somebody to watch their freaking videos, and no one's watching their videos. So the last thing somebody going to be doing is trying to figure out where your little place in Idaho is by combing through millions of unlisted videos. Like, that's like, I'm all for OPSEC, but let's not get over the top here, right?
Needle in a haystack.
Not everybody needs a skiff to have a phone conversation, right? Like, right. Yeah,
you can always call it
security through obscurity, right? That's a thing.
Yeah.
You know, like that's reality. That, like, you're so useless to the person that they're not looking for you. You know.
And there's also other file transfer websites like WeTransfer. You can send, you know, multiple gig files and I download it, and it's free. So
yeah,
there's lots of easier ways to do that. So
yeah, I send, you know, videos that are 5 to 15 minutes over Telegram all the time. Right. And you could do completely secret chat with Telegram if you're really that worried about it.
Yeah.
We have somebody that needs to be nuked. If you're one of my Twitch moderators, I know there's not a lot of you out there, but nuke this person. I can tell already they're just an idiot that we don't need. And I don't feel like logging into Twitch to get rid of them right now. But creamy cupcake, we're not interested. Go away. Bother somebody else. This is not what you're looking for. I think people really should deeply consider you for distance consulting. Even somebody that's like, well, maybe I could get them to come here. Like, it, you can then take that first pass at it, and then they can decide if they, well, do I need more assistance from you? Because,
right,
you know, and it also gives them a good idea of, like one of the biggest things you can do for people is be like, no, don't do that.
Right.
Right. Like a little bit of red teaming on some things. Like, don't do that. That's not going to work well for you. You're going to hate that. No, don't plant honey locust. That's a bad idea, right? Like, on that steep slope over there, you mean where all the rocks are? Yeah. Where it's going to sucker into a wall of thorn. No, don't do that. Or, you know, I'm going to put a pond here. Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. You mean the one that's going to, like, it's going to have sea by and it's going to flood your house? Don't do that. The amount of money a person can save by one good piece of advice that is don't do that far exceeds the fee of consultant charges. It really does.
Oh, yeah. 10x. Easy.
And we've seen it, right? When that,
Oh my gosh.
We said, ask us how we know because we did it. Some of these things we didn't do, but you don't have to live it to learn it, right?
That's right.
I got that from Landman. When a dude got his ass kicked by a bar waitress, and another guy's like, I wouldn't mess with her. He goes, bro, you don't have to live it to learn it. I'm stealing that. That is the line of the series right there. Like, nice. You do not have to live it to learn it. You can watch somebody else do it and go, well, that didn't work. That was a bad idea. And often you can look at it and go, well, it could have worked, but you did these three things and you should have done any of those three things. And so, like, yes, you can do that, but if you're going to do it, do this. Or yes, you can do that, but this is what's going to happen if you do that. And are you sure you really want that to happen? Like, there's a lot of things in the world like that. Like, Pond would be a perfect example of where I would always consult with somebody that's done it before. Because if you tell Billy Bob to come out there with his dozer or his excavator and put a pond in, he's going to look and find a dimple in your property that looks like it has a lot of catchment and some clay, and that's where he's going to put your pond. He has no idea why. It just looks like a pond already, so I'm going to put it there. And on a smaller property, that might end up being exactly where you did it. If its property's got any size at all, it's probably not where you're going to do it. Or even if you put a pond there, it's probably not where you're going to start.
Right.
Like, we're going to look at things differently when we have larger properties. We know we're going to always have some seep by, no matter how well a pond sealed. That's going to create some hydrology in the landscape. We need to think about that. Like, are you designing access out? That's another thing people do all the time. Like, I want all this stuff, and then you can't get around your property anymore. You know, I mean, well, one day I'll bring a pipe in, and no, you won't. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, you got like those things, you can save so much money and time by doing that. Yeah.
Well, one of the biggest ones that I think I save clients thousands of dollars just straight off the bat, let alone thousands of hours of labor over the next 10 years is fencing. They don't know. And what you don't know, you just don't know. And so, like, you're going to spend $20,000-$30,000 on fencing because that's just, well, that's fence. And you don't realize the amount of labor that one tree falling on that particular type of fence is going to cost you versus if you do it my way. And then on top of that, all of the extra, predator protection that you'll have to do with one particular type of fence that you just wouldn't have to if you did things my way. So, you know, that's one of those things that if you're putting up fence, I don't care if there's nothing else that you're going to get out of your consult. If there's nothing else, not a single other item that we covered is applicable to you. If it's just about your fencing, I can guarantee you I will save you $10,000. Yeah. If you're fencing 20, 30 acres, I will save
easy.
You.
Oh, if you're on that, I was going to say five. Like five easy. You could save somebody 10 grand from long-term cost of mistakes. Yeah, easy.
Yep.
That's a pretty quick ROI on that. Absolutely. I just want to throw it out one more time, guys. If you don't think you can afford him on site, but you're trying to figure out what to do with your land, this is really a great way to go. And it becomes very flexible with timing too then.
Like,
people don't think about this. Like, it's not just your time. It's their time. So the issue with that is, well, I finally can come. When? The week of October 14th. Don't write that down, guys. I just pulled that out of my ass. It has nothing to do with what he said. Okay, but I can't do it. We'll see you next year, right?
Yep.
And sometimes
maybe
that's the way that it's going to be, right? Maybe, right? Where if it's a remote consult, a lot of what you need them to do, you can send them kind of an intake, and they do that. And then you can schedule an hour here and an hour there. And if they don't, like, if you really need 3 hours with them, you don't have to do it consecutively. In fact, you'd be better off not. Right. I mean, you would be better off not doing it consecutive because most people don't have a 3 hour attention span. You know, like, I have members of my family who I will not name that don't have a 3 minute attention span. Right. So 3 hours, like, you could just forget about it. Let's talk a little bit about my fall workshop, though, like in my own self-interest. But, I mean, you are going to be here, and people do want to come meet. If they don't want to come meet you, there's something wrong with them. They should want to come meet with you. Nick is a consummate teacher like me. I've seen him up at 2 o'clock in the morning on a whiteboard with people, so it'll be worth coming to this. And this is like an illustration image, but, Nick, you know that picture well.
Yeah, I do.
That's a converted image. It's a real picture. I took that picture, guys. It was 2020 in the fall, or was it 2021? It was somewhere in the fall. The CDC had just come out and said, you can have, remember this? They gave us permission, up to 6 people at your Thanksgiving. And I'm like, oh, hell no, I'm out there. So I went out, told everybody what happened. And this was us. Literally the height of the pandemic. We did not give 2 shits. We had a blast. It was a great event. Nobody died. And nobody even went home and died, right? Like,
yep.
You know, it was a great event, and it'll be fun. So, but let's talk about, like, what are you going to be teaching at this workshop?
Yeah, so I haven't nailed it down exactly, but I've been playing around with a couple things. One of the curves that I keep seeing with just about every single one of my my clients is and you know, kind of touching on some of these topics that we've been kind of discussing and skirting around is the world news and world events and things that are happening regionally and food price. I mean, freaking beef just in the last 5 years has doubled in price.
Mm-hmm.
Chicken is even going nuts. All of this stuff is just going nuts. And the more I see the need for people to be producing some of their own food, maybe it's just 10-15%, but it needs to be something.
Sure.
The more I see the need for a real understanding, and I'm not talking high level understanding, but just a rudimentary understanding of the available nutrients in your soil. And so, you know, I feel like it would be a very useful topic to get into a lot of the practical implications and solutions for taking a almost certainly nutrient void or nutrient deficient soil that you're going to be growing in or producing animals on, even if it's just pasture, and moving the needle. I'm not talking about making it perfect. I'm talking about just moving the needle. Let's get things moving in the right direction. Let's get your soil tested. It's really not that expensive. I can give you the resources and you can learn how to do it yourself. You can do the easy button and pay me to analyze your soil for you. But I want to talk to people about soil health. And you know, kind of bring in that Pareto principle of we're not trying to be 100% perfect with our soil health, but let's get 80% of the way there. And typically it doesn't take a whole heck of a lot to do that.
Yeah.
And the implications of that are that I always, you know, this is one of my little illustrations. Let's say, for whatever reason, you are required to raise a significant portion of what you're feeding your family, whoever that is. If you don't have kids and your family is a handful of other people that you love deeply, that you're living with, kind of like roommates, they're still your family. And if you care about them and you want them to be healthy, you want them to be strong, you want them to be disease resistant, you need to have the nutrition to actually do that, to actually be healthy, be strong. You need zinc in your diet. If your soils are deficient or devoid of zinc, which a lot of them are really, really stinking deficient in zinc, where are you going to get that in your diet? If you're not importing stuff from California, from Venezuela, from Peru, from Chile, like right now, we import so much food from all over the nation and outside of the nation that we're getting a pretty decent mix of minerals.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you have to go and switch, you know, flip that switch and start growing in your backyard, if you don't have selenium in your soil in your backyard, guess what? It's not in your diet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't care how much.
An odd case, but a valid case for a little bit of globalism is that region A is deficient in selenium, but region B isn't. And region A has zinc and region B doesn't. So by being an import economy, we are mitigating things. Though I will tell you straight up, just the zinc alone, I think was a huge part of why a certain group of people took things so hard with COVID. Because when you get zinc inside the cell, then mRNA replicating viruses just shut down. Like it just can't, it's not the person won't get it. It just, it can't really run away because it just can't replicate very well. It actually shuts down a lot of cancers too. And that's not some BS that we're pulling out of our rear end, guys. This is known science. Like you can go to NPUB and you can look up dozens of studies on the effects of zinc inside the cell wall on the replication of viruses and not all, but many forms of cancer. Like this is the NIH, the people that everybody trusted like morons, even they admit it, right? Like that's the case. So I'm all for you doing some stuff with the soil. I think that would be a good idea. The other thing you had down was doing some stuff, especially hands-on with lactobacillus, PNSB, which is purple non-sulfur bacteria. I would love you to do that because some people make it way more complicated than it should be. I'm just going to put it that way.
Yeah.
And you might even know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And maybe if he'd stop squealing for 5 seconds, we'd understand what he's saying. Right? The guy's a genius, but he's too busy being himself to actually get something from him in a 45-minute presentation. And I'm with you. Like you're talking about a different way, but I have like some of my systems and the bluegills end up with like all this like white shit on them and all. And I'll just make up some lab and dump it in there with the curd. And they eat it and they get better, right? So that's just one example of using lactobacillus. And the purple non-sulfur I've used in my aquatic systems. I've never used it quite the way you're presenting here, though. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so both of those do somewhat symbiotic, similar things in soil ecosystems, in aquatic ecosystems. Even on the surfaces of leaves, for goodness sake. And I don't want to get too deep into it because I want to actually cover it in the class.
Sure.
This November, but you know a lot of this stuff, so many people get so excited and so nerdy and geeky about this that they talk about this stuff at such a high level that it just eyes glaze over and none of the information is getting in there. So what I would like to do is I like to really bring it way down and just say, you know, I just want you to try this.
Mm-hmm.
It's this simple. We're actually going to walk through it and I'm going to have, I want to have some bottles. I want to have some cultures and I want people to actually just make some cultures and just roll with it. And then they can just take it home with them. So, just make it, apply it and just look at the difference. Apply it in one spot, not the whole area, just one corner of your garden. Just see what it does. See if you can tell any difference. And I guarantee you will see a big difference. So, you know, like the PNSB, it will release different things into the soil ecosystem. than the lactobacillus. The lactobacillus has certain compounds that it produces that the PNSB actually eat and utilize, and then they produce other things. And then just the die-off of that bacteria after that bacteria blooms and it goes through its growth cycle, that is a whole bunch of bioavailable, basically chelated minerals and nutrients that are then available to the whole ecosphere in the soil as well as the plant roots themselves. So I think they work very well synergistically. I use PNSB in my aquariums, in my saltwater tank. Lactobacillus is fantastic for a whole bunch of stuff in our gardens and fruit trees and things like that. So I think a relatively short, hands-on, this is how you do it. Don't overcomplicate this crap. It doesn't have to be super geeky and nerdy. We don't need beakers and you know, yeah, graduated flasks and all this, yeah, stuff.
That's what we're doing. We're getting into the IMO stuff, the indigenous microorganisms and all. And
right,
I understand, like, when you go all out Chris Trump style. I get it. But
yep,
I'm trying to teach people things they'll do.
Right.
Right. And even if they're going to go there, when you give them these little biologics that they can use that are easy,
yep,
then maybe they're willing to invest more of their time and effort, you know? Because I remember the one video Chris did, and he's like, this is so easy. And by, like, stage three, I'm like, I'm tired from watching you, right? I'm like, this, I can make compost, uh-huh, like old-style, you know, 21-day compost, uh-huh, with less, uh-huh, physical labor than this. And a lot of this stuff is really super simple, right? You know, different thing, but same space. You know, you look at like bokashi or something. Like, you don't have to work your ass, right, off to do bokashi. Or it's a different thing, but it's still the same thing, like black soldier fly, like the frost, right? And what I've gotten the best results out of that is not using the frost. Feed the frost to the earthworms. And reprocess it, and then you end up with, like, I don't even know how to explain it. Like, it's like freaking throwing freaking steroids on them or something. The plants go crazy when you do that. I had some little bit of worm tea I made from, and it was frost through the worms, and I had like this little tiny cup left, and I'm like, it was in the spray bottle. The thing won't reach, and it won't come out. And I just dumped it on one of my wicking beds. And I went out 2 weeks later. It was like this pyramid. Only in the spot that I dumped it, right? Like,
that's,
it was
awesome.
Just, it was, what do you call it? Bee balm.
Yeah, yeah.
False, whatever it is.
I know the bed you're talking about.
Bergamot, right. And it was, yeah, just the center. The center was a foot in a week. It was a 2 week or two, 1 or 2 weeks. It was a foot taller than the rest of it. From that one little tiny bit of it. It was watered down. It was diluted for spray.
Mm-hmm.
And you see things like that, or you spray one side of a tree and you can't get to the other and it like grows out to one side. Like, you realize, like, we're coming at this all wrong. We're all thinking nutrient as in like, uh-huh, NPK and whatever. And like your primary and secondary nutrients, like you were talking about earlier, like your secondary is like selenium and zinc and all. These things are important. But you, yes, have very small amounts of them to be bioavailable. Right. Life is what unlocks everything.
That's right.
Life is what unlocks everything, man.
They're the two sides to the coin.
You were here in June, and I had those the snake beans starting to go up the trees. I've literally got like, yep, 4 foot long snake beans hanging from 18 foot up in an oak tree now. Those ones are going to be from seeds. Wow. They're never coming down in an edible fashion. I mean, like, I'm not kidding. I'm not exaggerating. 18 foot up, and you've got a bean that's like about as big around as my arm, hanging 4 feet down from 18 feet up. Or this shit. I think this thing was growing when you were here, but I hadn't harvested it yet. Right.
Uh huh.
You know.
This November, you're going to have to watch out. You're going to have dead ducks laying out there.
I might fall out the tree if they go under the wrong tree, man. I got to figure out, like, what to do. I got to make some Trumbuscino soup or something for the fall workshop, because I've got to have a truckload of it sitting out there right now. It's insane. but it's all biology. You know what I did for fertilizer this year? Nothing. Even the stuff we're talking about, like spraying, and I usually do that. I didn't do anything. I planted it when it, every plant, when it went in the ground, got basically a pinch of Dr. Earth 444. I've done nothing since. And it went insane, but it was years and years and years of building up that soil life. And so everything we can do to increase life in the soil, the right life, I should say, right? Not the bad life, but there's very little bad life. Mostly you have soil with no life or good life. You don't generally have a lot of bad. You have a little bit of bad because it's all it can survive. It's a life desert. That's the problem.
Right.
And they're usually trying to fix shit anyway.
Because life finds a way.
It finds a way. Man, this has been great. Thank you for bailing me out today, Nick.
Absolutely. Anytime, bud.
Yeah. You know that person, guys, if you saw the coming that was supposed to be on, he's probably never going to be on. I don't like being stood up over things like, oh, we got a question. We got one. I can't believe one question. Bruce, you know Bruce, he's actually going to be presenting too on composting. He's going to be here. Heard Nick say nut sedge growing is likely nutrient deficiency. My nut sedge grows in mulch through weed blocker in raised beds full of good compost and in the lawn. Please elaborate on deficiency. Nick's frozen again, I guess.
I'm digitizing over here.
All right.
So Bruce, it's going to be a combination of things. It's going to be a generally speaking, it's going to be a more anoxic or water, waterlogged soil. And I know you have a lot of moisture down there, especially where we're talking about. Just because it's in mulch growing through weed blocker doesn't mean, that your good compost is actually rich in the nutrients that it needs to be rich in. So, again, this is exactly back to what we were just talking about. If, let's say we have a region that is deficient in selenium, for instance, it's deficient in selenium and zinc and copper, and we make a whole bunch of really good compost. It's beautiful compost. Some of the most beautiful compost you've ever seen. Everyone agrees it's the best compost, right?
It's the best. It's huge.
It's huge. It's the best. I need to have really small hands back here. It's huge. Yeah. It's the best. If the parent stock or that compost is devoid of calcium, or not calcium, but zinc and copper and selenium, yeah, it doesn't matter how much compost we put on there. It's always going to be deficient in those minerals. So, Bruce, until you get a soil test done, you actually know what minerals you are deficient in, and you address those and add those minerals into the ecosystem, into your soil, and you start composting those minerals and recycling them back in, you're not going to address those deficiencies, and you're not going to see those things go away. I'm not saying that it is a silver bullet. It's always going to fix every single weed problem. It will do a tremendous amount to reduce the number of noxious weeds, things like nut sedge, you know, thistles, you know, those, you know, prickly thistles and a lot of the like Carolina nightshade and, you know, a lot of these really noxious things. The stickers, I can't even remember what they are.
Yeah. The ones I had here. Yeah. The
sand had,
they're gone. They're
right.
Gone. Yeah. It took five years.
It was bad.
It was bad. There were people posting pictures on Facebook 3 years after a workshop. I just found this thing stuck still in my gear, you know. David's dog would just be like, you know, you have to pull 20 of them out of the poor guy's paws. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what people need to get is like what Nick's saying is so important. I don't care how good your compost is. if you don't have some higher elements that are necessary micronutrients, then you don't have them. These things, like the amount of selenium on planet Earth is as much as there will ever be. You don't get new selenium. All you do is recycle it and move it around. Every one of these micronutrients, the guy we were picking on a little bit, he's brilliant as shit, that squeals, right? Like, you know, he has all these diagrams of every one of these micronutrients has its own cycle. And he's right, and they do. And so the reason they have that cycle is because they do not, you don't get more. You can't produce selenium. You can mine it. You can distribute it. You can cycle it, but you can't make it. What makes selenium is a star, right? It's a fusion reactor, and elements over a certain level, you don't get more of them ever without a fusion reactor. Sometimes it feels like it, but I don't have a fusion reactor in my backyard. So if I'm deficient in magnesium, right? Not only do I need magnesium, but even though I got calcium out the ass, I'm effectively deficient in calcium because the calcium's there, and without the magnesium, little bit of magnesium, the plant really can't get the calcium. Iron and zinc work the same way. You might have lots of iron, but you might be showing iron deficiency because you don't have any zinc. Or you might have zinc, but not iron. And in both of those situations, you're getting both deficiencies from a lack of one. Right. I think Bruce would do really well to get a soil test done. And Bruce, get it done before you come to present in November, and you can show it to Nick, and he can help you with it, and everybody else can watch and learn from it. That's what we should do. Today feels like a fusion reactor. Are you where I live? Because it does. Anyway, Nick, man, again, thank you for tuning in with us today.
It's been a pleasure, man.
Oh, hey, tell people your website.
Yeah. So if you're interested in consulting or trying to get on the bandwagon with soil testing, any of that kind of stuff, send me an email to nick@homegrownliberty.com. If it's about consulting, just put consulting in the subject line so I can sort them and make sure that I don't lose your email. And if it's about soil testing, just put soil or soil test in the subject line. And if you're interested in jumping on the either one of my in-person consulting tours this September, October, November, then shoot me an email with consulting. And if you want to get on a distance consult, they're quick and easy to do. We can schedule them just about any time of the day in the evening. A lot of people like to do it in the evening after they get the kids down. They're done with work or whatever. And we just sit down for a couple hours and we knock it out. 2 hours seems to be a really good sweet spot. Most everyone, that gives us enough time to cover everything and answer all the questions. And by about the end of 2 hours, people are either starting to get tired or it's just slowing down. So that's what I like to do with distance consults. But yeah, those two websites, and then later this around the first of the year, I'll have trees going up on rareplantstore.com.
Cool. Well, anyway, guys, if you didn't get all that because we had some breaking up in there, the audio side will go out about 30 minutes after we're done with this live stream. And there's a link right down in the video notes if you're watching the video instead of listening to the audio. Cruise on over there, or if you're listening to the audio and you're driving down the road or whatever, thesurvivalpodcast.com, look up episode 3893, because this could be, you know, me listening to it a few weeks in the future. And all Nick's stuff is already in the notes. I can't forget it because I already did it. It's all there, so you can jump on over. Nick, thanks for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
All right, guys, real quick, let me wrap up because that went long and it's late in the day because we got a late start because somebody bailed on me, man. But real quick, I do want to reiterate about the fall workshop coming up. It's going to be a blast. The dates are going to be November 11 to 15, but the date you need to know right now, September the 19th, 9 a.m., be there or you don't get to come. I am not kidding. It is not a sales technique. We have sold this event out. I would say for every 10 events we've done, we've sold out like 9.5 times out of 10 events. And we've done probably 50 events because there were years when I was crazy and I did three or four in 1 year. A few years ago, we went like just doing one a year. And that makes the pressure even higher because people know they get once a year to do it. On September 19th, we will be dropping the sign-up link into our Telegram channel and our Telegram group. That's the main way. That's where we start. I give it about 5 minutes, and if it makes that, I throw it out on social, and I pop everybody an email, and then it's definitely gone. So if you want to go, you need to be prepared, and don't miss that date. Stay tuned. I've got a lot more information coming probably tomorrow on the actual subjects. There's a post out already. You're looking at it on the screen. But I've got some great speakers lined up as always. I got some surprises this year with food. Chef Ken Daniels is coming. We might be doing something so cool. I don't want to say it yet in case it doesn't happen. Then you'd be pissed at me. But it's going to be pretty cool, and it's all because of Chef Ken. Chef Michael, as many of you guys know, has moved to Tennessee. He is still coming to run the main kitchen. So he will be here as always, which is great because he does a fantastic job. We'll have music. We'll have karaoke. We'll have barter blanket. We'll have like a whiskey tasting or something like that. This is a one-of-a-kind, unique homesteading permaculture prepper workshop, convention, call it whatever you want to. I don't believe anybody else in the world does what I do. The closest is Nicole Sauce, and it's very close. But anything else you go to will never be like this because it's either not going to have as much cool stuff or it's going to have so many people you don't have the intimacy. We limit our tickets to 50 students. That puts a total head count of around 80. That's me, my wife, instructors like Nick, et cetera, all together. It is an incredible networking experience. And I'll tell you how you know you're doing it right. This is more like the two things that most tell me I've been doing this. Yes, whiskey tasting, not testing. We'll test it by tasting it. But these are the two things that make me so happy about all the work that goes into doing these events. One is when I say who's been here before on orientation day, 60% of the hands go up. When I say who's been here to more than five, 25 to 30% of hands go up. I don't know many events that have something like that, especially that are in some dude's workshop on his property personally. I don't really know of anything else like it. Again, Nicole Sauce, right? And then the other reason that I know we're doing it right is what's going on at 10:30 in the morning on Sunday when you're supposed to leave. When I have to send somebody like Nick or Michael or somebody out to go, you have to leave now. You have to go because there'll be, and I swear to God, if you're here, you'll see it. There'll be at least a dozen people still all right at the gate waiting to leave, and they don't want to go home because it'll all go away. If you want to be part of something like that, stay tuned. Get on after the workshop. We charge $600 for it. And I bet you we feed you. If Nick was still here with us, he would tell you we feed you more than $600 worth of food per person in real value over 3.5 days. We have a great menu lined up this year. Some stuff we've never done before. Some stuff that you guys are used to. It'll be fantastic. I want you guys all to come out. And also just stay tuned. I have some really cool additional stuff coming tomorrow for you. That AI course that I was talking about said maybe I could put it together pretty quick. A 15-day course on how to choose the right business if you don't have a business yet and you want one. We might just be dropping that next week. I think we could do it today, but we want to make sure everything's just right. But I did my part, and Tom's busting his ass doing his side of it. That's going to be an awesome course, and it's going to lead to some other shorter AI courses. It's going to be like, I don't know, $700, and actually we have kind of a really cool launch plan where you can save a bunch of money if you're one of the first 100 people in. But this will not be like the big course where if you don't get in, you're out. Just pay more. So pay attention for that too. Take care, guys, and I will catch you tomorrow with an expert.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better